Herzlich willkommen bei Jacobin Weekly. Ich bin Lauren Ballhorn, Chefredakteur von Jacobin und auch der Host von diesem wöchentlichen Politik-Podcast. Es ist ziemlich viel passiert in den letzten 7 Tagen seit unserer letzten Folge. Die Linke hat eine neue Parteispitze, zu der auch meine Jacobin-Vorgängerin Ines Schwertner gehört. Und in den Tagen nach der Wahl dieser neuen Spitze und nach dem Bundesparteitag, wo ein großer Kompromiss zur Nahostpolitik beschlossen wurde, sind eine Reihe von bekannten Politiker aus dem sogenannten Reformerflügel ausgetreten. Darüber könnte man bestimmt lang und interessant diskutieren heute. Doch da wir bereits letzte Woche eine ganze Stunde zu dem Thema gehabt haben, werden wir diesmal woanders hinschauen. Nicht innerhalb Deutschlands, nicht mal in Europa, sondern wir blicken über den Teich, glaube ich, so spricht man das aus, auf das Land, wo ich die ersten 2 Jahrzehnte meines Lebens verbracht habe, die Vereinigten Staaten von Amerika. Auch bekannt als Deutschlands zweitbeliebste Projektionsfläche, aber das mal nebenbei. Worum geht's? Ich glaube, das wisst ihr. Ich weiß es auch. In weniger als 2 Wochen wird in den USA gewählt. Ich gehöre zu den 7% der im Ausland lebenden Amerikaner, die ihren Wahlrecht auch in Anspruch nehmen und gewählt habe. Aber darüber wollen wir eigentlich nicht heute sprechen, weil meine Stimme wird wahrscheinlich wenig Unterschied dabei machen sollen. Wir wollen ein bisschen tiefer und ein bisschen genauer auf die letzten 4 Jahre der Biden-Regierung blicken. Wir wollen auch auf die Kampagne von Kamala Harris schauen. Was macht sie gut? Was macht sie schlecht? Warum kämpft sie immer noch so stark in den Umfragen gegen Donald Trump? Und natürlich, warum oder wer will es nicht, wollen wir über den ehemaligen und möglicherweise zukünftigen Präsidenten der Vereinigten Staaten, Donald Trump, sprechen. Was macht er eigentlich oder was macht ihn eigentlich so attraktiv? Warum wählen so viele Menschen aus der Arbeiterklasse ihn? Warum stimmen sie für jemanden, der ziemlich explizit ihren Klasseninteressen widerspricht? Und was ist eigentlich passiert mit der so inspirierenden und hoffnungsvollen sozialistischen Linken in den USA, die und in den Jahren nach die Kandidaturen, den Kampagnen, meine ich, von Bernie Sanders entstanden ist? Warum hört man von ihr nicht mehr so viel? Mein Gast dafür heute ist Matt Karp. Matt Karp ist ein Professor für Geschichte an der Universität von Princeton in New Jersey, Autor von mehreren Büchern über die amerikanische Geschichte, vor allem auch die Sklaverei und die Bewegungen dagegen, und auch regelmäßiger Autor bei Jacobin und anderen Zeitschriften, wie zum Beispiel Harper's, wo er neulich 2 wirklich sehr interessante Artikel veröffentlicht hat, über zum einen die Entwicklung der amerikanischen Linken und zum anderen die sich verschiebende oder verändernde Klassenbasis der 2 großen Parteien im amerikanischen Parteiensystem. Ihr habt gehört, Matt Karp, Professor für Geschichte an University of Princeton. Er ist aus den USA und wir werden deshalb in dieser Folge ausnahmsweise Englisch sprechen. Das wird nicht untertitelt und es wird auch nicht übertont. Das ist leider technisch in so kurzer Zeit nicht realisierbar. Wir werden uns aber bemühen, klar zu sprechen, und für alle, die das Interview gerne hören würden, aber dem Englischen vielleicht nicht so mächtig sind oder einfach keine Lust haben, eine Stunde lang 2 Amerikaner auf Englisch labern zuzuhören, kann nächste Woche auf unserer Website www.jacobin.de eine deutsche Übersetzung des Gesprächs lesen. Wann genau, kann ich dir noch nicht sagen, aber das erscheint auf jeden Fall in den kommenden Tagen. Letzter Hinweis für die, die nicht weiterhören möchten. Für alle, die in Berlin sind, Veranstaltungshinweis: heute Abend, der 25. Oktober, Freitag, in Berlin-Kreuzberg. Wir veranstalten eine Diskussion mit Peter Mertens, Generalsekretär der Belgischen Partei der Arbeit, dessen neues Buch Meuterei, wie unsere Weltordnung ins Wanken gerät, auf deutscher Sprache erscheint die Tage bei unserem Brumair Verlag. Wir werden mit Ines Schwertner, mit Katja Barthold und mit Mario Neumann für Medico International und natürlich mit mir über das Buch sprechen, über Peters Perspektive auf die sich verändernde Weltlage, was sie bedeutet für sozialistische Strategie im 21. Jahrhundert. Und vielleicht, wenn jemand die Frage stellt, vielleicht aus dem Publikum, was die Genossen in Belgien eigentlich machen, dass sie so erfolgreich macht. Das war heute nochmal 20 Uhr im Veranstaltungsraum Aquarium, Scalitzer Straße, Scalitzer Straße 6 in Kreuzberg in der Nähe vom Cottbusser Tor. Ich bin dabei, hoffentlich seid ihr es auch. Bis dann. Hi Matt, and thanks for joining us this week on Jacobin Weekly.
Hey, happy to be here.
Let's dive right in. It's less than 2 weeks away to the election, especially here in Germany or in Europe, after Biden sort of unceremoniously passed on the baton to his vice president, Kamala Harris. There was initially quite a lot of enthusiasm. It seemed like to me, looking or watching from this side of the pond, that there was also enthusiasm in the United States. Nevertheless, it's now 10 days away, 9 days away, I don't even know exactly. And she's struggling in the polls. Trump and Kamala seem to be more or less neck and neck. She's actually really behind in several swing states, including Pennsylvania, which we're going to talk about later. But could you kind of first just give us an overview? Why is this situation looking so dire? Why is there a real possibility that Trump could be elected on November 5th? What has gone so wrong in the Democratic camp?
Yeah, just to give you my version of the last month, and my from, you know, boots on the ground here in Park Slope neighborhood of Brooklyn, New York, you know, where real America resides. Not only was there an atmosphere of enthusiasm, there was tangible material evidence of that enthusiasm. You know, after Biden had been trailing the fundraising race, for instance, to Trump, and all of these, you know, the Times was running all sorts of stories about Silicon Valley and Wall Street, you know, sort of Wall Street billionaires are now turning toward Trump. You know, Kamala raised $1 billion in less than a month. She had an enormous outpouring of support that had been bottled up, that had been sort of, you know, stifled in a sense by Biden's, you know, incapable candidacy, you know, because it was really just so clear, even to some extent before the debate, but then especially after the debate, there was about a month of just twisting in the wind and Democratic donors had been sitting on everything. And then there was this gush and you saw it in the polls to some extent. I mean, she certainly made up ground on where Biden had been sitting. And then I think that carried all the way through to the convention, essentially. But yeah, for the past month or so, it's been back to a stalemate. And I don't know if that's necessarily, I mean, I guess conceptually it's dire from a broader perspective, but I think it's also quite understandable from, you know, zooming out. You know, this is a year globally where incumbent parties have not fared well in this sort of global election year of 2024. You know, we talked about something more than half the world's population was going to the polls. In pretty much every major election I can think of, now there are a lot of complicated cases, but in pretty much every major election from, you know, I don't know, Britain to India, you had incumbent ruling parties presiding over the sort of post-COVID inflationary economy who took hits. And there was a lot of throw the bums out sentiment in the global economy right now. If we even want to talk about sort of world politics, I think that's a accurate statement. And there's no reason to assume that it wouldn't happen in the United States. I mean, I think maybe the one country that has bucked the trend is Mexico, but we can talk about them. You know, somebody who actually knows about Mexican politics should talk about that. It's an interesting counterexample. But broadly, I think that's true in Europe. I mean, I know a lot of the incumbent parties in Europe have, you know, really either they've, you know, flailed in elections or they're struggling in approval ratings. There's just not a lot of popular support for the current office holders. I think one lesson, the broadest political lesson, it's on some level, it's less intrinsically, or at least at the surface level, it's less scary or sort of doom laden than the idea that, you know, hordes of fascists are sort of emerging from the sewers. But another level, it's really troubling for any left political project. But yeah, the lesson is people really hate inflation, I think. And the popular disgust with disdain, frustration, aggravation, kind of bad mood around even moderate levels of inflation that are in the United States anyway, as the economists continue to, especially Democratic economists continue to assert, are matched by, you know, really strong wage gains. That has not added up to people feeling good about the economy. And there's a lot of talk about how, oh, this is largely determined by partisanship. And so all the people who are saying they hate the economy are just Trump voters, and everyone just answers every question about the economy in partisan terms. I mean, that's just flat out not true. The most loyal section of the Democratic base in the United States, a very working class demographic, African Americans, the majority of African Americans say that the economy is not good. Now, this is a group that you could, you know, run the numbers and say, oh, actually, black wages have, you know, increased under Biden, you know, far better than, you know, XYZ. But in comparison to the price increases, those gains are pretty small. And in comparison to how things seemed, the memory of things seemed before COVID, they're pretty frustrating. And so the fact that there is full that there is close to full employment, you know, we're not in a, you know, dire recessionary environment. Nevertheless, people really don't feel good, and they don't like the economic situation they're in. And of course, in the United States, that's exacerbated by structural conditions. The fact that, you know, we lack basic healthcare protections, we lack childcare, we lack support for housing. We have all of these things are baked in. And yeah, it's fine for liberals to say, you know, that leftists are complaining about a sort of a sturdy fact of the American experience. But that fact comes into play when people are feeling economic anxiety. And I think that's a real thing. Plus, you know, as I think Adam Tooze has recently been arguing, you know, a lot of these core inflation metrics that say that inflation has been tamed in the U.S. are really exclude food and gas. And these are the sort of most visible, most tangible. Yeah, they're really variable. But, you know, cereal in my neighborhood is $8.50. It's insane. You know, just on the Jerry Seinfeld principle alone, you would want to vote for the opposing party to get cereal that back at a $5. I want a $5 box of cereal, for goodness sake. So I think that's actually, and on one level, yeah, that's, you could say that's sort of comforting. It's less scary. On the other level, you know, I don't need to get into sort of political economy, and it's a little bit above my pay grade, but I think a lot of, you know, sort of left Keynesian kind of economic projects do sort of depend on the idea of a sort of running a low to moderate to significant inflation, and that can be, you know, redistributed through wage gains, and that this is the kind of economy that, you know, can work for us. And I think it's a little bit bracing to sort of say, wait a minute, there are huge political costs to this kind of, I'm not even blaming inflation on Bidenomics, you know, so to speak. I'm not sure that, it seems to me more persuasive that it's a global post-COVID issue, has to do with, you know, supply chains and the war in Ukraine and other sorts of factors that aren't, you know, directly under the control of the fiscal policy. I mean, the Fed has obviously been trying to reduce inflation here to a significant extent. So I don't think it's just as simple as like spending produces inflation. But, you know, the fact is we have had this inflation and people hate it a lot more than we thought. And yeah, that's brought them back to Trump. And so, you know, there's a parallel process that we could maybe talk about why Trump has become, you know, he's more popular than ever now. His approval rating is actually higher. You know, I thought that there was a year ago, I was really optimistic that there was going to be a significant Trump fatigue, that even the sort of liberal lawfare against him, all of the criminal charges on these sort of, you know, on the sort of the Stormy Daniels case, a lot of this stuff that seemed pretty marginal that I thought was really politically ineffective, it still felt like, you know, you're throwing darts into this big beast and you're maybe going to bring him down. And there's just going to be a fatigue and an irritation with him continuing to whine about the stolen election, him continuing to make everything about himself. And, you know, for better or for worse, I think for worse, from my perspective, he's avoided doing that. He has not made this campaign about that. He has managed to sort of inject fun and, you know, from this stupid McDonald's appearance recently, where he went and served burgers out of the drive-through, to the assassination attempt where, you know, which was a sort of perfect theater for him. He's kind of managed to sort of, reinvent himself. He's just much more compelling as an opposition figure than as a figure in power. And just as in 2016, there was what people called the sort of key the car impulse, you know, just the destructive kind of just throw a rock through a window because this shit sucks kind of impulse to vote for Trump, that he's a rebel, he doesn't care. He's kind of reconfigured that again. And he's made everything feel like a joke and not that serious. And I think a lot of people are voting for Trump because they're fed up with the status quo. And he feels like in some way opposed to that. And they're not really seriously what he stands for himself.
Yeah, exactly. Even though he himself was the face of the establishment, some kind of weird funhouse mirror version thereof. but was actually the president 4 years ago. So, and I really would like to talk more about Trump and also the appeal that he has. I do think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think a big part of it is stands in a stark contrast to kind of the alarmist pearl-clutching tones with which the liberal establishment talks about Trump that I think for a lot of people in the United States, around the world as well, but in the United States it's more immediate, he's just kind of made everything into a spectacle and made people not take politics as seriously. And on that note, I still want to ask you, what does that say about Biden's record, really, and the performance of, you know, Bidenomics in the last 4 years of a Democratic administration? Because you wrote in an you said in an article you published a few months ago in Harper's, and it's something that is also very true of kind of left liberal discussions in Europe when we're talking about the United States. There seems to be this common sense idea that left wing ideas are in broader circulation now, that like kind of neo-Keynesian ideas influence the Biden administration, and that kind of soft social democratic politics, as maybe as Bernie Sanders' legacy, are informed democratic policy making a lot more than they did before. But if that was really the case, first of all, is that the case? But if it is, does that mean that our policy prescriptions, what we were pushing, or we as the left were pushing for when we got behind Bernie, don't matter at the end of the day when you have an opposition candidate who can turn the thing into a joke and win, you know, through his sheer bizarre magnetism?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated question, actually, because I don't dismiss the idea that left-wing ideas coming out of the Sanders campaign, probably in some ways enhanced by Hillary Clinton's sort of defeat in 2016, and to some extent a kind of delegitimization of that sort of 1990s Clinton era centrism, you know, the sort of general turn that I think actually applies to the right as well as the left. I mean, obviously you see this in Europe too, away from, you know, a really dogmatic laissez-faire kind of 1980s, 1990s, you know, neoliberal sort of, you know, ideological extremism and towards this kind of national conservatism, whatever it means. It doesn't mean that they're against the market now, but it's about leveraging the relationship between the market and state in different ways. It is about, in the Trump's case, specifically promising to protect the existing elements of the welfare state, you know, like Social Security, for the existing recipients of those benefits, which is something that Republicans never used to do. So I would sort of just say that in some ways, in macroeconomic terms, both the left and the right in the U.S. have actually ticked to the left compared to where things stood, the sort of median consensus, you know, 20 years ago. Some of that is Bernie. Some of that is a lot of it, though, I think is actually sort of about the exhaustion of the neoliberal paradigm and the fact that it's just simply not working in economic terms. But so I think that's broadly true. And I think it's also specifically true in the Biden case. Yes. And yet the truth is what Biden achieved. I mean, I really think there's been an enormous amount. Talk about inflation. There's been an enormous amount of hyperinflation of what Biden's sort of left wing record. Yes, he spent more money than on, I guess, broadly liberal left priorities in terms of green energy, in terms of other things in the Infrastructure Act than presidents have in the last 50 years. But that's a really, really low standard from the perspective of any kind of social democratic project. You know, so, you know, saying he's the most left wing president since LBJ is actually just not saying a lot. And I don't actually think he was, because not to sort of take Obama's side against Biden in this sort of silly little Democratic you know, pissing contest. But the Obama administration, although in other ways it was sort of much more centrist in its both in its brand, its positioning, and its, you know, putting somebody like Timothy Geithner in charge of in charge of Treasury at the peak of the economic crisis, the amount of opportunities it squandered, all of that stuff, you know, totally accurate characterization of Obama. But Obama still did Obamacare. Obama still did you know, expanded medical care coverage in the United States by, you know, a significant bounds through a sort of a permanent social program that came with an expansion of Medicaid that actually, like, you know, was a structural change in, you know, a reform, a moderate reform, but it nevertheless was a big, nothing Biden has done is like that. You know, it's just been about spending more money. It's about sending some checks out, which, by the way, Trump did too. It's been about, Biden eliminated child poverty, but for a few months. There was never any plan for this to be the permanent state of affairs. It was a post-COVID Greece that also came along with, whether it caused or not, I leave aside, that also came along with a lot of really unpopular inflation. So his sort of the sort of left Keynesian element of Bidenomics, whatever it was, we got some of that, but none of it really transformed itself into or sort of bedded down into the existing political economic structure of the country in terms of the existing welfare state, in terms of, how the relationship between jobs and the global market. Yeah, Biden has been tougher on trade. Yeah, Lina Khan has been good on, going after some monopolies. There's been some stuff on the margins. Yes,
Biden. Can you say who that is really quick?
Oh, sorry, that's Khan. The FCC. That's the trade commissioner. Okay, maybe this is a place for editing because I can't remember a specific title right now. But she's, essentially responsible for bringing regulatory action against big businesses and against monopolistic companies and so on. So, and Biden has been strong on unions, at least rhetorically, although he did, break a train worker strike, during his administration too. But anyway, there's definitely been movement, but I think the liberal writers, John Judis and Roy Teixeira wrote something about that. Yeah, Biden represents, they had a line like under Biden, the Democrats have sort of, the light, has turned green, but we haven't hit the gas yet. Like in terms of an escape from neoliberalism, like there's been a rejection. There's been a sort of opening from this sort of austerity driven balance the budget, cut government spending, public partnerships, all of the sort of things that throttled any kind of state expansion or any kind of even social democratic branded sort of social programs in the 90s and even to some extent in the Obama period, because Obamacare itself was, of course, a public-private kind of thing. It was a huge subsidy for the insurance market. Some of that has receded and there are openings, but the gas pedal that got hit with a really narrow majority in the Senate was essentially just a lot of spending. And some of it was important on roads and bridges and stuff. A lot of it was on these green energy projects that are, also important in the broader struggle against climate change, but they're relatively evanescent. And if you didn't get a factory built in your hometown, if you didn't get a new chips plant that came in, if you didn't get a new bridge in your neighborhood, then you didn't really see it. And in fact, all you saw was you got a little check and then that money bled away and everyone's telling you how great the economy is. Yeah, you're employed, but you're struggling to pay rent. You're struggling to buy that $8 box of cereal and, you're not happy. And can Biden then retreat to some high ground and say, okay, but I did do this. I did give Americans health care. I did give Americans paid leave. I did give Americans affordable child care. I did something that is like the hat hanging accomplishment. Instead, it's this sort of basically what they do is trot out a chart, and a chart is not a substitute in my mind for a real program. So I think there's, in some ways the blame for this is not entirely on the center either. I think there were a lot of progressives who in the negotiations over Build Back Better, over Biden's signature bill, were really pushing for a, let's just throw everything in here and see. We might not get one or two things, but we want to just get as many bits of as many things as we can get. And once we get this expanded child tax credit, everyone will want to keep it. We'll just throw a lot of money at the problem and that itself will create a constituency. Well, that didn't work. It didn't work. And I think going forward, one thing we've learned from a sort of a left liberal perspective, if you will, is in that policymaking space. To me, it's much more important to have one or two signature programs that will last and that deliver something tangible than what Bidenomics did.
Well, then maybe we can look back or return back to the question of Trump's attractiveness, because you mentioned a couple big ticket items, whatever you want to call it, like Obamacare. Also talked about, Social Security. So existing social programs that Trump is not attacking, or at least promises not to attack, though correct me if I'm wrong, he continues to make noise about repealing Obamacare. He says he'll do something better, but is very vague about it, right? I mean, why is it that, I mean, if in many ways a lot of the problems you're describing, the difficulties afflicting the Democrats, primarily inflation, presumably would have also hit a second Trump administration just as hard. What is it that gave Trump some kind of reputational sticking power? Because he also didn't have, other than the COVID checks and, you know, moving the American embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv, there weren't really any major big ticket policy he passed as well.
I guess he got the tax cuts.
The tax cuts. Okay.
You know, which you know, but again, those, most of those, you know, yeah, there was a sliver, as is usually the case with Republican tax cuts. A sliver went to the middle classes, and the lion's share, of course, to, you know, corporations and the very rich. But no, I don't think people are sort of remembering their tax bills and are sort of supporting Trump out of anti-tax sentiment. I don't think that's the main story. I mean, it's unsatisfying. It's so simplistic, but I think you're right. But I think the truth is he's out of power now, and we have short memories. And sometimes, to some extent, people do have fond memories, not of Trump's tax cuts, but of the pre-COVID moment, just of the of an American economy that was doing pretty well numerically, but didn't have these price shocks and didn't have this instability and didn't have, and yeah, one might say, yeah, but Trump floundered so badly under COVID. But in some ways, COVID sort of spanned both administrations and doesn't really land on either one of them specifically. Fair or not. I mean, I think there are legitimate criticisms of Trump's handling of COVID, but in general, I think there's a combination of a little bit of nostalgia for the sort of pre-COVID moment. And much more significant than that, though, I think just short memories and the fact that, yeah, if Trump were in power now, I think he would be desperately unpopular. I actually think the Democrat wouldn't even be this close. I think the Democrats would probably be maybe not running away with it because we're a pretty polarized country, but would have a more satisfying lead heading into this home stretch. And it may be that we're entering a period. I mean, who knows? Maybe this is optimistic, but, or I don't know what it is. We may be entering a period where the norm of the incumbency advantage at the presidential level is so sturdy. I mean, if Trump wins this year, we'll have three straight challengers win elections. I would say automatically if Trump wins this year, I mean, I guess he won't be an incumbent, but I would say whatever happens in 28, the Democrats would start out as significant favorites in the odds books. And that we're just in a period of passing the baton because people aren't happy and the country is so divided that all it takes is, you know, a handful of votes lapping in one direction or another. And I think the sort of, you know, fuck you, this sucks sentiment just tends to favor the opposing party. And those are the two formations.
Pretty grim prospect, no, in terms of trying to build any kind of political project with a longer term vision. I mean, if obviously as people on the left.
Choppy waters. How do you put an oar in these choppy waters? But I think, you know, it's not like the left was really, you know, paddling along with such, you know, serenity under the, you know, first Trump administration or whatever before or in the late Obama years either. So in some ways you could say that there's opportunity in all of this chop and all of this slop and that there's, you know, intense dissatisfaction with what's being offered now. I mean, you see that on in the fact that both major campaigns are largely running on what the bad things the other party's going to do. It's all negative polarization, as the political scientists say. It's all, you know, well, I don't know how you feel about me, but you really hate the other guy, right? And, you know, Kamala is literally putting Trump on the jumbotron at her rallies now. And some of that is, I think, in service of this very failed, you know, character, temperament, threat to democracy kind of argument that we could talk about that Democrats are addicted to for a number of reasons. But some of it is also just flat out, like, yeah, when you see him and you're a Democrat or a Democrat leaner, like your mind turns red and you want to support Kamala. And I think, you know, Trump ads I'm seeing here in New York, which is interesting that I'm seeing any, but I guess I'm seeing them on YouTube TV, so they're kind of national. I don't have a satellite dish anymore. I don't have an antenna anymore. They're all, oh, Kamala supports trans surgeries for prisoners. Kamala's crazy. You know, they're not even, I haven't even seen a Trump assassination ad, you know, a kind of hero Trump ad. They're mostly about Kamala being, you know, extreme on some cultural issue, or Kamala presiding over the failed border, Kamala mm-hmm, letting mm-hmm. all the gangs in, Kamala presiding over a failed economy and laughing about it. You know, they're all kind of, you know, I wouldn't say hate messages, but they're all negative messages on both sides. Yeah. And it says
a bit,
something.
Not a bit, very paranoid on both sides.
Yeah. Yeah.
Always kind of I mean, you talk about that also in your recent article in Harper's. It's kind of the gap between reality and the way it's depicted in this kind of hyper-polarized, overheated political rhetoric. But let's talk about, what kind of messaging can break through that, right? Like, you're associated with the Center for Working Class Politics, which put out a study just the other day about voters in Pennsylvania, which, for those of our listeners who maybe don't know, Pennsylvania is a key swing state in the election because it's fairly divided between Republicans and Democrats, and candidates from both parties have won in the past. So it's one of the few states where democracy in the United States actually functions similar to the way it does in a normal European country, normal democratic country, sorry. What did the study figure out about, what did you find out in terms of what kind of messaging works among potential left-leaning voters and what really doesn't?
Trying to figure out where Pennsylvania, what's the place, we can sit at the bar sometime and play a game. Like, is Pennsylvania like somewhere in the Ruhr Valley? Like, what's the German Pennsylvania? You know, it's kind of like post-industrial, but it's also got this rural component. It's sort of more conservative. You know, it's not a sort of, it's, despite being on the East Coast, it's not, even its flagship metropolis, Philadelphia, does not have the sort of cachet and the sort of international power of a New York or a Washington or even a Boston. It's a sort of a working class state in the broadest sort of atmospheric sense. It has, you know, African American population. It has a little bit of everything. It's a crucial battleground. And yeah, so the Center for Working Class Politics like did a survey of 1,000 Pennsylvanians, and we polled who's ahead, you know, Trump and Kamala, and like everyone else, we found a really tight race. I think Harris actually had a small lead in our poll, within the margin of error, very tight. And we also alongside that regular poll, we did a couple things that were different from most pollsters. We looked at occupational class for one thing, which is just something that is, I think, much more common in surveys in Europe, but very uncommon in the United States, where we didn't just look at, you know, oh, did you graduate college? That's our proxy for class, which I think is he said un-Marxistly, a kind of acceptable shorthand in a lot of ways about people's life chances. It says a lot about haves and have-nots and about life potential and so on. But occupational class is better. It's closer, at least, to something like a more rigorous conception of class. So we looked at different categories of workers. And then we also, even more unusually, we, through a number of different political messages at these survey respondents in Pennsylvania. So some of them are drawn from Kamala's own rhetoric, and some of them we wrote, and we matched those messages up as a sort of a would-be Harris message against a number of Trump messages, things that he said that are existing, or formulations of existing Trump messages. And, in a sense, it allows you to test, like, which, in a sort of simulated head-to-head, which messages are the strongest. And yeah, we found, you know, that the Trump as a convicted criminal who's a threat to democracy, who's going to cancel the Constitution, that message polled by far and away the worst among all voters, among independent voters, significantly among working class voters, who are this key constituency in Pennsylvania, but obviously in the United States in general. And then on the opposite side, we found that the strongest messages were sort of more aggressive populist versions of things that Kamala actually hasn't said yet, but we didn't write a full on chest bared, you know, Bernie Sanders, democratic socialist message. But they were things like attacking the billionaires, which she's done, attacking the billionaires who rule Washington. She hasn't really done that because, you know, she's got her own billionaires in Washington that she likes.
Right. Yeah.
So sort of amping up the rhetoric a little bit, attacking sort of both parties. That's very effective. And then offering on the sort of progressive economic side, offering things like, you know, guaranteed jobs or expanded Medicare, things that, again, she's not saying, but, you know, one can imagine a Democrat saying. And, you know, we didn't say, we didn't even say Medicare for all. We didn't say, you know, comprehensive, you know, green energy by 2030. You know, we didn't say something really, really aggressive. We just said, you know, sort of broadly popular, incremental reforms in the direction of a social democratic program that are a bit more aggressive than what she's done. And those were the two messages, the populist and the progressive economic message that performed the best with, not just with all Pennsylvanians, but again, within the same groups, the independent voters, that's the swing voters, and the working class voters, including, you know, in a sense, the American working class is very divided right now. That's why we talk about class de-alignment. You know, that's a situation where it's not that the working class used to be in bloc Democratic and is now Republican. It was always divided, but the majority of working class Americans through unions, through, you know, party machines, through all sorts of other reasons, especially, you know, civil rights, black, African-American loyalty to the Democratic Party in the 20th century, was majority Democratic. And now it's pretty much shot through the middle. Maybe it leans a little bit Republican, but it's really divided. And a lot of those divides are gender and race, geography. A lot of them are also occupational. So sort of blue collar manual workers, truck drivers, construction workers. Jobs that tend to be more male are very strongly Trump voting right now, including even unionized workers. And, you know, workers in sort of service industries, you know, workers at, you know, food service, clerical work, in sort of retail, tend to be a little bit more, well, much more Democratic, not strongly Democratic, but lean Democrat. And both of those working class groups also were really drawn to this populist rhetoric, and to a significant extent, the progressive economic rhetoric. More than I would add, this is in competition with Trump messages, and more than Kamala's standard sort of focus group tested messages that are sort of about building an opportunity economy, the sort of more moderate message, a soft populist message where she did sort of attack corporations for price gouging, but she didn't say the billionaires ruled Washington. I mean, these are sort of subtle differences, maybe, but I think it really communicates, you know, the fact that there are were significant discrepancies between them communicates something. And most surprisingly of all, from my perspective, the abortion message, which is, you know, often seen as the Democrats' strongest political message, given that, you know, something like 60% or more of Americans strongly support a woman's right to, you know, to decide to have an abortion. And you know, even in red states, even in very Republican states, referenda have voted for, you know, abortion rights. And so, you know, this is why Democrats talk about abortion all the time. And yet it doesn't seem like it moves votes. There are a lot of people who support abortion and are voting for Trump in this election. That's just a fact from the numbers. We see that. And just simply saying he's going to outlaw abortion nationally doesn't seem to move them. And we saw that in this message because we tested a specific message that, you know, made the argument that Trump was what was coming after abortion nationally, and Trump had opposed abortion. He'd ended Roe v. Wade. You know, that's partly true to some extent. And that message performed better than, say, the Democratic threat message, the threat to democracy, which was the worst performing. But it was also it was underwater in comparison to the populist message. So, you know, it won support from professional class voters. It won support from the Democratic base. It's not that it's not popular. It's not that it doesn't have any support. You know, all these messages are pretty good at rallying Democrats. But if you're trying to win swing voters, and specifically if you're trying to win back working class swing voters, you know, the broad demographic type that's been trending to the right, then, yeah, it just seems, you know, it seems demonstrated in the real world 100,000 times. But now we have one more hard data point that populist rhetoric pays off.
And why do you think the Democrats have proven so resistant to adopting that kind of messages? I mean, and continue to double down on this kind of Trump is a threat to democracy message, although it failed in 2016. Most of the polling indicates it's failing now. Is it just a political unwillingness on the on behalf of the Democratic establishment to embrace social democratic politics, despite all of the chatter about everyone being Keynesian now?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think there's actually a division within even the sort of inner chamber of the sort of DNC headquarters on this, or whatever the version of that is. Because if you look at Kamala's super PAC, you know, this thing Future Forward that is a huge political action committee that can raise untold, unlimited sums of money that has nearly $1 billion. And they've been spending a lot of money on ads that have working class people complaining about the economy, and then quote Trump saying at the Republican National Convention, saying, well, I know some of you are rich as hell, and kind of talking about his rich friends, and then having this average person, you know, this Joe worker American, then saying, I'm not rich as hell. You know, he's out for those guys. He's not for us. So now that's, I still want to make a distinction between these kind of ads and populism, because these are anti-Republican, anti, you know, anti-rich guy messaging. And so there's an element of sort of an economic fairness element, but populism, for me, it also means some attack on the governing institutions and on a sort of something broader than my political opponent is rich and wants to help his rich friends. There's something broader about the status quo that is rotten in a populist analysis, and whether it's, and it has to go beyond just the merely partisan. So I don't actually think that they're full on partisan. In some ways, structurally, they can't be, because they are these institutions. But I think some part of the campaign is, you know, they apparently, there was a Times article about they'd spent, you know, millions of dollars polling, survey testing, doing all this stuff. I mean, we spent like a couple thousand dollars on this survey, and they basically came to the same conclusion, like, this is our best message. But not everybody agrees, because there's a lot of Democratic constituencies that want to, that are for institutional reasons, are attached to a number of other messages, to the sort of smorgasbord of Democratic ideas that really say, no, it's really important that we campaign on abortion. No, it's really important that we specifically target Black voters. No, it's really important that we specifically like have an environmental message. It's, you know, whatever, that's probably the weakest of those. But there are constituencies like that that don't want this broad-based populist messaging. And then to answer the second part of your question, yeah, there's the fact that this kind of class transformation of the parties in America has made, I mean, which has happened in Germany too, obviously, look at the Green Party, has given, you know, this left center party a different kind of constituency whose values and instincts and sort of positionality is geared around this anti-democratic message. And that stuff, it's not just that they like it. And actually, in our polling, they didn't rate it any higher than some of the populist messages, even professionals. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. But clearly, you know, in some way that can't be captured by this crude experiment, it clearly registers. I mean, I just know anecdotally, and, you know, somebody like my mother, like literally all of my friends' mothers feel very powerfully on this Democratic issue. And it's far and away more powerful to them than, oh, yeah, Trump might, you know, Trump might hand the economy to Elon Musk, or Trump is, you know, friends with rich guys. They are generally, yeah, they're opposed to that. But that's kind of standard practice Republican stuff to them. What they really fear about Trump is this specific threat to essentially annul the Constitution and set himself up as a dictator or something. And that just feels way more vivid to this class of people. I do think it's not so vivid to a lot of swing voters and working class voters. You know, and we see that, but I think it's very, very powerful. And they, you know, in some ways you might say the Kamala message is a bit different from Hillary's message. Hillary's message was more that Trump was, just to parse it, Trump was unfit. You know, he was, his by temperament and character, he was sort of revolting. There was the, you know, the grab him by the pussy tape, the stuff about his, just his sort of boorish manner and his kind of, indulgent and kind of, you know, extreme lifestyle, his debauchery, his corruption. There was a lot of that kind of character criticism. It wasn't actually, oh, he's a fascist that much. This, the sort of democratic threat thing is a post January 6th file. And look, it's legitimate to some extent. He obviously, you know, January 6th was not a joke, and he and members of his party are interested, to the extent that they can manage it, in tilting democracy In their favor. It's at the legal level, at the institutional level, at the level of the party, you know, down to party chairmanships in, you know, counties in Michigan that might be, you know, that. And so I think I'm not even dismissing that institutional threat, but I think that this kind of message is so overpoweringly meaningful to basically people who watch the news all the time and are living in this world where this like dark force has been gathering since January 6, 2021. And if you're not in that world, if you're not following all that stuff, even leaving aside the merit of those claims, I don't actually think Trump has anything like the capacity to become a dictator. But even whether that's true or not, I think it falls flat with somebody who's not kind of a news watcher in that sense.
Plugged into that feedback loop. Yeah.
Yeah.
You brought up or you mentioned class de-alignment. So, I mean, I think everyone listening knows what that means, and you already kind of laid it out. There's a trend that you describe in your recent article, or a tendency rather, that you describe in your recent article in Harper's, that more and more, particularly manual workers, people without college degrees, are voting Republican. Whereas the Democrats are more and more becoming the party of, you know, the kind of the professional middle class and the sorts of people you just laid out in your last answer. How deep do you think this shift really goes? You know, like we can see a trend in Europe that, yes, there are, particularly in countries like France and Germany, sections of the working class are moving to the right or even to the far right, but not in the way that I think sometimes people on the left imagine it, and that they're decamping individually only at the ballot box. They're not leaving their unions and joining far right street fighting organizations, right? This is a very atomized and kind of superficial, shallow shift to the right. That's part of just kind of a wider depoliticization and atomization of our society, which also sucks for the left, since our whole gamble is that we can organize people to, you know, fight for their interests. But how much of a threat do you think, or a possibility, is it that some kind of working class Republicanism really consolidates and becomes a real force in American politics? You know, you have kind of gadfly figures like Tucker Carlson that sort of gesture at that, and the occasional elected Republican. But is there any real substance to that? Or are we looking more at the kind of fuck you vote phenomenon that you were describing?
Yeah, it's fuck you all the way down, I think. I think it's similar structurally to what you described in Europe. It's very atomistic. And yeah, for me, the real threat from Trump is not fascism. It's just total social corrosion. You know, it's like what he represents is that completely alienated, isolated, only fans, online gambling, you know, fuck you, you know, doom scroll, social media, whatever, you know, just this sort of complete sort of dropping out of all of these like healthier, chunkier, more, you know, existing social forms. I don't think he's a Christian nationalist or is plausibly at the helm of a movement that can be described as Christian nationalist. You know, church attendance is way down nationally. You know, people are not members and believers in the same rates that they used to be. And that those trends are not halting under Trump. Now there are all sorts of far right figures in the stew. There've always been. I mean, those people have been around for 75 years and saying different versions of this stuff. And you can always follow some little knotted pathway from some far right intellectual to some politician. And I think it explains very little. What's happening is a product in the class de-alignment terms is, I think, two things. And the future is indeterminate. But I think two things. There is this global, you know, post, you know, what do you want to say? Post-industrial phenomenon that, you know, Piketty and others have sort of documented, where parties of the left have sort of have ceased to become the automatic home of working class votes in a period of globalization, deunionization, in a period of neoliberalism, economic, you know, austerity. Left parties have sort of moved to the center and picked up professional class votes everywhere. But there's another phenomenon that's I think is a little bit more specifically American, although there are some European analogs, but in the last decade that I associate to some extent with Trump and with the Democrats under Trump, who've changed just as much as Trump has. And it's has changed the Republicans. And it's because it's really accelerated if you look at the voting numbers anyway. I think it's, again, like you said, it's very thin and atomized. It's not like there are thick cadres of Proud Boys sprouting up all over this country. Like, they're not. These people are phonies. They're online commenters. You know, it's just the thinnest, most sort of saddest in some ways form of social being and social belonging. But the vote for Trump in working class districts, you know, compare it from 2012 to 2024, I'm sure it's going to be this way, all the polls suggest, is really striking and significant. It's something like a landslide. And it's not racialized. You know, that's the thing that everyone is sort of, you know, in 2016, everybody was like, oh, it was a white slide. It was a, what was the word? It was a white, not a whitewash.
White lash.
That's right. And yeah, I mean, like, whatever this is, it's not. In fact, like, you know, Kamala's voters, I was just seeing Kamala's doing as well with white men as Biden was. You know, Biden was up in the polls. You know, Biden did better with white men than Hillary had, and Kamala might do better yet, especially with professional class white men. But it's a brown lash in this sense in the last 4 years, especially as you've had working class Latinos, especially overwhelmingly, but to some extent black men, to some extent certain Asian communities. There have been, to some extent, Native communities. You can even see it. There's been a sort of a broadly less educated, less less professionalized, more socially alienated and isolated in these economic terms, tendency to sort of clump with him. I think it's an open question whether that second phenomenon, how much of it is sort of, you know, conjuncturally determined by Trump as a sort of a unique figure. They don't have a lot of sort of Trump 2 or Trump 3 in their garage. You know, J.D. Vance, whatever he is, he's just something different. You know, Ron DeSantis is something a lot different and lesser. You know, they don't have anyone with the magnetism, with the charisma. I mean, maybe you can just start recruiting new celebrities who can come in and fulfill that role. But I think Trump is a bit of a one-off. You know, he's sort of stuck around a long time, but he is kind of a unique figure. And I think if you'd imagine an election with a sort of a Democratic Party of Kamala Harris and a Republican Party that is sort of a MAGA-fied party, but has, I don't know, you know, has Ron DeSantis or Marco Rubio or someone at the head of it, you know, or I guess J.D. Vance is now in the poll position. I don't think it has the same pull. I mean, it may sort of retain some of the votes that Trump had won and people are still sort of residually invested in that project. But I don't think J.D. Vance collects the fuck you vote in the same way that Donald Trump does. I think that, I think... Even if J.D. Vance is in some ways ideologically more, you know, interesting, so to speak, than Trump, and that he's you know, has, you know, he's even murmured heretical words about tax cuts. You know, he's the most sort of national conservative of these guys on paper. But I think what he represents, his demeanor, all of the sort of afflatus around him, is very, you know, Yale Law School at the end of the day. And he's not actually going to inspire that kind of the fuck you energy, that sort of rebel energy among working class people. I don't think he can. And I don't think any of these guys in that orbit can, unless they can find some other sort of, you know, wrestler or something to sort of step in and be that new guy.
Hulk Hogan is only like 70.
What?
Hulk Hogan's only like 70.
Yeah.
He could make
exactly.
a run for
I mean,
it.
It may be that they actually go in that direction. We'll see. But I think there's a little bit of faint optimism that in the post-Trump era, which will get here eventually, that things will look a little different, and that, you know, maybe it'll be just no worse than Europe, you know, like, because right now our trends have been worse than yours in the last 10 years in terms of de-alignment. So, and I think they're going to be ugly this year. I think Kamala has not actually shored up that vote. At all. And I don't know if it's really her fault. I don't think Biden necessarily would have. I think it's just Trump plus the economy. But it's going to change. It's going to require some sort of significant change to break this trend. I mean, look, you have, I guess I should pump this one more time. I mean, there is an alternative view possible. Like, there's this guy in Nebraska who's running, who I've become very interested in. This Senate, Nebraska is a very rural, I don't know what you would describe it. It's like, what's the most conservative rural part of Bavaria? It's like, it's a very right-wing part of the states. It's not poor particularly. You know, it's farmers and a few mid-sized cities. And it's, you know, has been reliably Republican for literally, you know, 150 years. And you know, with a slight populist interlude maybe in around the turn of the century, but it's been one of the most Republican states in American history. And there's a guy running for Senate there named, you know, who's a former, you know, sort of mechanic who worked for Kellogg's cereal company and led a strike. He was a union guy, the union leader. He led a strike. He won the strike. The company fired him. He's a veteran. I mean, he kind of has it all on paper. He even has the same last name as Nebraska's legendary football coach, Tom Osborne. And he's running this campaign, which is all about attacking the millionaires and the billionaires in the Senate, that is genuinely populist in the sense that he's as running as an independent, not as a Democrat, and so he can attack both parties. But he's very much running as a labor guy, as a union guy. He was recently Sean Fain, the sort of, you know, leftmost union leader, the UAW leader in the States. Probably the most important like left labor leader we've had in a long time, came out and was campaigning for him. I don't think that Dan Osborne is some kind of is a sort of a Marxist Leninist who's going to sort of lead the people back into you know, set up a People's Republic. But I think he represents a sort of a style and a mode of doing politics that shows, you know, running against his opponent as a stooge of corporations and kind of pushing a lot of the other stuff to the margins, that he's finding a lot of success, you know, sort of backpedaling where he needs to backpedal, but really resolutely and with a lot of discipline, like Bernie had in some ways, just zeroing in on these key issues, on this key issue of the rottenness of these institutions and the way that the rich run this country. He's had a lot of success. So to me, that actually is a mode of inspiration. You know, right now he's polls are showing him neck and neck or even ahead. I think he's still an underdog to win in this really very conservative area. But the splits have shown so far that he's won, made a lot of headway with working class voters, with blue collar voters. So we'll see with the election, even if he loses by a handful of points, I don't know how much it matters to have him in the Senate. What matters to me is that there's potentially it's another real life experiment where we can see the power of this politics in America.
That's a great segue actually into the last question I want to ask is, where is the left in all of this, right? I mean, you had a piece a couple months ago in Jacobin. You also had another one a couple months ago in Harper's, both of which were, to put it nicely, maybe a bit pessimistic or a bit negative about the prospects for the democratic socialist left in the United States. And where you kind of almost, you hit, express the idea that maybe socialists are a bit overly positive about what real impact they've had on politics and society. And we really haven't, except for the Gaza demonstrations, it feels like, at least, you know, from 10,000 kilometers away, the Bernie, post-Bernie left is not really a factor in American politics at the moment, and that's certainly not, or correct me if I'm wrong, I'm hoping you'll correct me, not in the Democratic Party. What would you, would you agree with that? What do you think kind of has happened in the last 4 years that saw all this momentum dissipate?
Yeah, actually the piece I wrote was kind of actually began with Palestine because, you know, I do think it was actually sort of a clarifying moment. And maybe this is not fair given the sort of particular history of the United States and Israel, but I still felt that it was clarifying how little influence, you know, despite an impressive mobilization of people in terms of rallies and protests and all sorts of, you know, really strong energy, how little impact that had in the institutional, leaving aside the Joe Biden administration, but how little impact it had on the Democratic, you know, caucus in Congress, for instance, how completely, and I know that that's not certainly not the fault of the protesters, but to me, it shows how the left, while whatever influence it claimed that it had, you know, with AOC as this sort of new party, you know, sort of progressive party favorite, it just showed to me that when the rubber hit the road in a really vivid way, where you had like even the sort of progressive caucus, which was described as the largest caucus in Congress, it had 100 members, which is almost half the Democratic coalition, and only about like 30 of them could muster a vote against, you know, sort of stopping arms sales to Israel. It might not even have been that many. I can't remember the specifics. It was really dismaying in terms of if you think these people, I mean, it actually was a little less dismaying to me in the sense that I didn't really ever think the Progressive Caucus was going to, you know, come in and save our bacon. I guess I would have thought some more of them would have stepped up on this. So maybe that's a particular issue. I don't know. But to me, it sort of suggested when there's something that the centrist leadership of the party is really committed to, whether that's Israel-Palestine or whether that's honestly taking a risk on some sort of popular social program that would involve a major hit to the sort of, you know, democratic leaning industries or democratic, you know, what Hillary Clinton loved to call stakeholders, you know, mm-hmm. that is powers that be in the economy and in society, that they would put their feet down and that the progressives would be revealed to be a sort of a insignificant fringe again and again. And so, that's what happened on Israel-Palestine. I feel like that might happen any number of times going forward. So, that was a moment where I was like, well, what have we done to sort of isolate ourselves from power in this way? Well, and some of us have been celebrating our gains and, you know, oh, there are more of these socialist, you know, city councilors than ever. You know, we have two seats on the municipal council of Bellingham, Washington. You know, like there are, you know, socialists are sprouting up everywhere. Whatever. I just made that up. So apologies to Bellingham, Washington, you know, and whatever honorable socialists are doing there. But I think there's a kind of, essentially for me, the real issue is this de-alignment phenomenon, which has happened to left of center parties broadly, to the Democrats specifically, has happened to the left too, obviously. And I'm a living personification of it. I mean, obviously, like, there have been left-wing university professors and magazine editors from the beginning. So, you know, we have an honorable tradition, Lauren. But like, the constituency of the socialist movement in America are all people like us now. You know, it's entirely grad students and aspiring magazine editors. So that's not enough people. And even if they are kind of congregated in some neighborhoods that can win even significant seats, like a state Senate seat in New York or something, it's still really, really, really fractional. And there needs to be some effort for the left to kind of get in touch with the working class again. So, and I know that a lot of organizations are, you know, I'm not the first to say this. This is, we people go to meetings and they begin by whiplashing each other about this all the time. So it's not that there's like a lack of intention, but I do think that there's been a lack of strategy. And I do think that, to me, it seems clear that what works for somebody like Osborne, although he's not particularly on the left, as far as I can tell, would work for the left too. And it might look a little different, but that embracing elements of this kind of populist formation and focusing specifically on economic issues, and hammering that kind of class politics. I mean, we saw it with Bernie. He did expand the coalition. I mean, come on, he did. In 2016, he won Michigan. You know, he won a lot of people who weren't grad students and aspiring magazine editors. He really did. And why have we abandoned that vision of that broader public, the sort of boring populist politics that it wasn't that long ago? I'm not talking about reviving the New Deal coalition. You know, I'm not talking about, you know, organizing the South under the CIO. I'm not talking about, I mean, actually I am, I'd love to talk about the anti-slavery movement of the 1850s. I'd love to talk about it. I'm writing a book on it, but this wasn't that long ago that we had a Bernie movement that it was hitched to this particular camp format of this one politician, running in a primary that's not the same as really deep institutional. But it's not clear to me. I think it's without weighing into the intra-DSA politics, it's not clear at all to me that the DSA has like followed a Bernie strategy since 2016. You know, that the Bernie 2016 strategy has been like operationalized by the American left broadly. Like, I don't think it has. I think it's been a lot of other things, you know, some of them very worthy. But one thing that they haven't done is build that mass base, build that working class base in a meaningful way. And look, I'm not an expert, especially at the inner workings of the socialist orgs. And I know that people work very hard for these things. And I'm not, I actually am sort of hesitant to sort of make uncomradely criticisms in that way. So I don't want to just be throwing mud, but I think when you zoom out, I mean, this is all I can do is zoom out. I'm permanently on out zoom. And I'm, you know, what we're not seeing is a left that is rooted in a working class, or a left that has capacities or maybe even aspirations of winning a mass base. It doesn't seem like that's what the priority is right now. And I would say that that's probably true of the Gaza movement too, which I fully support. But this is also not a politics that's designed to sort of, I mean, I think it one could win votes on Israel. I think our position is more popular than the Democrats probably, honestly. But I also think it's not tailor-made to like convince somebody to sort of join the left.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't mean it's not important to do, I support the protest, but I think it's just another example of something that is not, it's not focused in that sort of laser-like strategic way on building the masses. It's kind of, you know, we're sort of comfortable with being a protest movement. I mean, I guess there are worse things.
Yeah. I mean, you could be in prison. You could live in a society where you can't protest. speaking of that, that's actually the last question I'd like to ask you. So you've hinted several times during our conversation that you're not convinced that Trump is going to establish some kind of neo-fascist dictatorship. I tend to agree with you, at least in Europe, but also within the Harris campaign and in a lot of liberal media, that is not the case. There seem to be millions of people who genuinely think that fascism is on the ballot on November 5th. But let's just, for argument's sake, let's assume Donald Trump is going to win in 2 weeks. What do you think realistically will that mean, both for American workers and also world politics as a whole? Because as you know as well as I do, the United States, more than any other country, has a very real and immediate impact on politics around the world.
Yeah, I mean, big question. I wish I had a crystal ball. I think, hold on, I got to rummage around the closet to get my Palantir. I think my argument against Trump as a sort of, as a dictator is I made it in effect in the last Harper's piece I wrote about, where I essentially tried to sort of look at do a sort of social power analysis between Democrats and Republicans. And the Democratic Party, based on, you know, the crude but I think significant measure of campaign donations, really dominates so many sectors, the dynamic sectors of our economy, you know, from, and I know that there are these rogue CEOs and billionaires who are with Trump now, and that's not insignificant. You know, it means a lot. You know, it's, the Musk thing is one of the most revolting elements of this particular Trump campaign. But I think the sort of high level boardroom of all those tech companies, the judging by their donations of huge swaths of sort of venture capital, of hedge funds, of management consultant groups, not to mention the traditional power bases in place in things like corporate law, in places like universities, which are not actually powerless. You know, which have huge amounts of social prestige and institutional power, in places like, in this government bureaucracy, which is also not powerless, you know, despite what you hear about America as a libertarian state, we have a huge public sector. In all of these places, the deep state is a real thing, my friends, you know, all these places are not dominated by the left, obviously, far from it, but they are democratic and they are not sort of amenable to MAGA co-optation, which is essentially the story of, you know, right-wing coups and takeovers in, you know, 20th century history. Is usually it involves winning a beachhead in these sort of core sectors. Nor, frankly, have we seen any evidence that the military is leaning more Trump. He spent his whole term arguing with the military. There's not, you know, the Cheneys, et cetera, are against him. And I don't think that I don't think that helps win votes in Pennsylvania, but I think the fact that Dick Cheney is against Trump does say something significant about where the about this institutional power question, which would essentially, even if Trump wanted to, which I'm not at all convinced he does, even if Trump wanted to do the sort of extreme Project 2025 thing, there are so many roadblocks on the way there. And in fact, his party is good at just about one thing these days. It only has one realm of power. It's the political. The Republicans are not on the front foot culturally. You know, they won in the Supreme Court because they won elections and they got lucky and they nominated Supreme Court justices. But there's no popular cultural movement against abortion. I just was reading the Times today. There have been more abortions in the United States since the end of Roe v. Wade. And even in many of the states that have the harshest bans, they're not winning on they're not winning hearts and minds on all sorts of levels, even their own party. You know, they're going after trans stuff with Kamala. But, you know, the way the Republican Party has moved left on LGB issues is, you know, inarguable over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, they're, because the country has moved left. It's not their virtue. It's just that they've had to chase it. They're chasing the game culturally. They're in a weaker, their economic strongholds are in like old fossil fuel industries and like fast food and, you know, hardware stores and stuff. It's not the beating heart of the sort of the 21st century capitalism. So they're just on every level, they're kind of on the back foot, except they're pretty good at winning elections. And that's, to me, that's like a, not a great scenario for the left or for, you know, for the country, but they're not in position to do this. Not to mention that, you know, not to be too sort of a historical nerd, but this stuff, the reason why these institutions were co-opted, the most important reason why in Germany, I mean, again, this isn't my period, but I know a little bit, why a lot of those sort of centrist institutions ultimately, you know, sided with the fascists of the 20th century was because they feared a really powerful mobilized left. And so in a funny way, if we had a really strong, you know, 15%, you know, American KPD right now, and then you would see Goldman Sachs singing a different tune. Maybe Goldman Sachs would say, well, you know what? I don't like Trump, but we can deal with him. And that would be a really different scenario. I mean, in some ways it would be more exciting. In other ways, it would be, I think, a lot more dangerous. In some ways, the total non-existence and demobilization of the left has meant that liberals sort of have nothing to fear except the right. And so they are, I think, and I don't think they're likely to say, oh, actually, we like Trump now because, you know, we're getting our taxes got cut or whatever. We have a crypto portfolio. I mean, the Republicans are all over this crypto stuff. It's like this marginal kind of, you know, get rich quick. It's that same OnlyFans online gambling mentality. They're the party of desperation. They're not the party, not to mention, yeah, you asked me about a second Trump. I mean, I've said this, I'll say it now. It's going to be a lot of golf and scandals, I really think. And it's going to be, and more social corrosion. Yeah, more crypto, more, you know, deregulation of, you know, more probably poisoned drinking water, more sorts of like really bad stuff that will hurt people, more microplastics. Microplastics will accelerate. That's a prediction. I mean, it's like literally corrosive stuff. So I don't want to be diminishing it. And this sort of this stupid trap of this fascist argument is that it turns people who hate Trump into like sort of weirdly apologists for him, because I loathe this guy and what he represents. But it's just crazy to say, to put him in the clothes of interwar Europe. And as a president, I think he will check out entirely. I mean, I'm convinced he loves the campaign. He loves to perform. But second term presidencies in the United States, especially when they don't have like massive mandates, even when they do, even when Reagan had a huge mandate in 84, he didn't do a lot. The biggest sort of policy, you know, the big tax cuts, the big, you know, sort of things we identify with Reaganism were all first term. Second terms are usually, you know, kind of biding time. There's sometimes a foreign policy thing. That's a big question mark. But domestically, I don't think there's going to be a lot. And I think Trump is not very interested. Yeah, will he hand the keys to Vance? Will he hand the keys to Elon? Will there be some, you know, Stephen Miller sort of, you know, nasty rodent-faced, you know, kind of anti-immigrant people kind of taking over? Probably a little bit on the margins in all those cases, but no, there's no grand MAGA plan for sort of coordinated glacial tongue. You know, it's not happening. It's going to be scattered and disorganized and corroded like everything else he touches. It's like that blood in Alien, the movie that, you know, seeps through the ship. That's what Trump is. You know, he kind of bores everything he touches. It just sort of disintegrates. And so that's what it's going to be. And I think it'll be a lot like the first term. Honestly, I do. Mm-hmm. And I think he'll be more checked out. I don't mm-hmm. think he's physically well. You know, he's going to be 80. So it will be very bad is the short answer. It'll be very bad. But I think there will be room to fight him. I think there will be room to, and do more than fight him. I think there will be opportunities to continue to fight for the country too. So.
Well, Matt, that was a reassuring and dispiriting conclusion at the same time. Nevertheless, thanks a lot for really interesting conversation. I would have loved to actually delve more into the increasing prominence of crypto on the campaign trail. It's something I can't quite figure out, but we'll have to reserve that for next time. Thanks again for taking your time, and good luck next week.
All right. I can't believe it's that soon. Thanks so much, Lauren. Auf Wiedersehen.
Das war Jacobin Weekly für heute. Vielen Dank an meinen Gast Matt Karp, dass er die Zeit genommen hat, uns über die wirklich nach wie vor sehr spannenden Entwicklungen in den USA aufzuklären und vielleicht auch ein bisschen zu versichern, dass am 5. November, egal was passiert, weder die amerikanische Demokratie noch ihre imperialistische Vorherrschaft von der Weltkarte verschwinden wird. Das ist natürlich eine Beruhigung und eine Beängstigung zugleich, aber die Welt ist halt manchmal so widersprüchlich. Und vor allem danke an euch, die alle bis zum Ende zugehört haben, obwohl wir diesmal ausnahmsweise auf Englisch gesprochen haben. Aber für die, die das gerne nochmal nachlesen würden oder das vielleicht gern mit Freunden und Bekannten teilen möchte, die kein Englisch verstehen oder weniger Englisch verstehen, wir werden eine deutsche Übersetzung dieses Gesprächs nächste Woche veröffentlichen auf unserer Homepage www.jacobin.de. Und das bringt mich auch zu meinem letzten obligatorischen wöchentlichen Punkt, nämlich: Jacobin ist ein kleines Unterfangen. Wir sind davon abhängig, dass viele Menschen sehr viel Zeit und Arbeit reinstecken, ohne wirklich viel Kohle damit zu machen. Und wir brauchen euch, unsere Zuhörer und unsere Unterstützer und Fans, um den Laden weiter am Laufen zu halten. Der Weg, in dem ihr das am besten tun könnt, ist, indem ihr einfach unser Magazin abonniert unter www.jacobin.de/abonnieren. Oder wenn ihr noch weitergehen möchtet, könnt ihr uns auch mit einer monatlichen Spende unterstützen. Die kann man auch auf unserer Homepage einrichten auf jacobin.de/spenden. Alles, was wir machen, machen wir für die Sache und sind wirklich nur die Magazine und die Bücher, die uns über Wasser halten. Deshalb, sofern du es noch nicht getan hast, sind wir wirklich für jeden Einkauf und jeden Abo dankbar. Ich bin nächste Woche wieder da mit einem neuen Gast zu einem neuen Thema. Und in der Zwischenzeit könnt ihr auch jeden Tag neue, frische, kostenlose Inhalte lesen auf unserer Site jacobin.de. Bis dahin.